so Kurt had borrowed the powerboat and a modicum of diving gear and other equipment from a rental outfit, all of which would be returned in one piece, or paid for by a disgruntled Numa accountant. Akiko was at the wheel, while Kurt checked the wind, and Joe prepped the diving gear. "Turn to the northwest," Kurt said. "Take us out a couple miles, and then turn back to the island." Akiko turned the wheel to the right, and the boat leaned into the turn. As it straightened up once again, Joe arrived from the stern. "I'm sure you know what you're doing, amigo, but the island is that-a-way." Using his thumb, he pointed over his shoulder. "That's going to make for a long swim." "Observant as usual," Kurt said, "but having studied satellite images and 100 other pictures, I can tell you swimming is not the way to go here." He pulled out the laptop and showed Joe a high-resolution aerial photo. "There's a 40-foot seawall encasing the entire island, complete with waves breaking against it and tricky currents sweeping past. If we didn't get battered to death against the rocks and the foundation of the wall, we'd be quickly dragged past and dumped back in the bay." Joe nodded. "There's a dock here and pilings on the far end. Stairways in 3 different places. We could use those." "The dock is concrete and designed for a larger boat," Kurt said. "The pilings are a concrete jumble at the far point of the island. You know what the surfers say. Points draw the waves. We'd be fighting the current and the breakers. As for the stairs, those are the most obvious points of access on the entire island. Unless Han is a fool, they'll be monitored and guarded."
"So why bring all the diving gear?"
"We need a way off the island when we're finished," Kurt said. "If we can find Nagano and get him out before the tide changes, we'll have an easy ride into the bay."
"I'm glad we have an exit strategy," Joe said. "Thinking ahead, I consider that growth. But how do we get on the island in the first place?"
"Did you wonder why I took this particular boat?"
"It has nice lines."
"It also has a lot of torque and towing power, which they use for the adrenaline junkies and their new sport, wingboarding." Joe cut his eyes at Kurt.
"Wingboarding?"
"It's like parasailing, only you have a chute above your head and a wing beneath your feet."
"We're going to fly onto the island?"
"Glide onto it," Kurt said. "Akiko will pilot the boat as we get up to altitude and then tow us in. We cut the cord about a mile out and ride the sea breeze toward the island. Instead of crawling out of the water like a couple of amphibians, we'll drop in from the sky like a pair of owls."
"What if they have radar?"
"Doubtful," Kurt said. "That island is supposed to be abandoned and off limits. They won't have a radar installation, searchlights, or anything else large or obvious. Nothing out in the open that would give them away. At best, they'd have a surveillance system of hidden cameras and motion detectors. But they'll be outward-looking, watching the perimeter for intruders approaching from the sea, not inward and monitoring the deserted center of the island."
"So fly in over the top of their perimeter, and what?"
Pulling out a pair of goggles with large, oddly shaped lenses, Kurt said, "These have infrared sensors built in. By approaching from the sky, we'll get a full view of the island. Whatever Han's people are doing, they'll need lights, power, and equipment. All those things produce heat. Heat that will be easy to see on an otherwise cold and deserted island." Joe understood perfectly.
"We'll scan the island as we descend and then follow the heat trail like it's the yellow brick road."
"I'll scan," Kurt said. "You're the pilot. I'm counting on you to do the flying. And the landing. On the roof of one of those buildings." Clad in black neoprene, Kurt and Joe took their positions on a 12-foot wing at the back end of the powerboat. They stood side by side, each of them with 1 foot forward and the second foot back, behind and canted sideways, a stance that provided balance and control. Backpacks strapped to their shoulders held the compact oxygen bottles, masks, and fins that they would use to swim off the island once they found Superintendent Nagano and any clue suggesting what Han was up to. With their feet set, they grabbed a pair of guide cables that would allow them to maneuver the wingboard and the parasail that would rise up above them,
A short video told them how to control the wing.
This doesn't seem too hard, Joe said. Lean left, it turns left. Lean right, and it turns right.
How far in do you want me to take you? Akiko asked.
Kurt had already done the calculations. Get us within 2 miles and then give us a little waggle. We'll pull the cord.
Her eyebrows went up.
2 miles? That's a long way out.
According to the information I read online, this contraption has a glide ratio of 12-1. With the cable fully extended, we'll be almost 1,500 feet above you, high enough to cover 3.5 miles. But considering the headwind and our inexperience guiding this thing, I want a safety margin to play with. 2 miles will do just fine.
Akiko nodded, glanced at the GPS receiver, and then looked back over her shoulder at the two of them. Ready?
Joe reached up and double-checked a pair of goggles currently perched on his head. His were designed for night vision. While Kurt's looked for heat, Joe's amplified the available light. As they closed in on the island, Joe would pull the goggles down in front of his eyes and look for a landing spot. With the goggles strapped securely to his head, Joe gave the thumbs up and set both hands on the guideline. Kurt did the same.
Release the cable.
Keeping one hand on the wheel, Akiko reached over and pulled on a lever to her right. Clamps released, and the parasail billowed out behind Kurt and Joe, filling with air. The lines snapped taut and pulled them back as the wing beneath their feet disconnected from its moorings. In an instant, they were airborne and rising fast as the cable spooled out from a drum in the back of the boat. They climbed with surprising speed as the two wings provided ample lift. By the time the cable was maxed out, Kurt could see all of Nagasaki lit up, but all he could see of the boat was the shimmer of the wake it was leaving behind. Working together, he and Joe practiced a few maneuvers. The wingboard responded easily, working in perfect tandem with the parasail above. The ride through the cool night air was smooth as glass.
Easy peasy, Joe shouted over the wind. The trick is going to be controlling it once the cable is cut. The wings are staggered like an old biplane. As long as we keep the parasail filled, we'll have control. But if our forward speed drops too much and the sail collapses, we're in trouble.
Kurt looked up at the graceful curve of the parasail stretched above them like a crescent moon.
If that happens, we pull the emergency release and dump the wing. We'll lose some distance, but we can parachute down. Did you pick a landing site?
I studied the satellite image, Joe said. There are 40 buildings on that island with a flat roof. Plenty of landing spots. Which one we pick all depends on the angle of our approach. I'll make a final choice when we get closer.
You lead, I'll follow, Kurt said.
Kurt nodded and reached for the radio strapped to his arm. Turn toward the island. Keep an eye on the GPS and give us a little shake when we hit 2 miles. We'll pull the cord and glide the rest of the way in. Once you feel us go, haul in the cable and make your way back to the channel between the island and Nagasaki.
Will do, Akiko said, her voice reaching Kurt through the earbud. Good luck.
The lights below went dark, and the wake began marking a curve to the left. A few seconds elapsed before the cable began to haul them around in matching fashion. Leaning to the left in tandem, Kurt and Joe easily maneuvered their flying machine into the turn. As they straightened up, the island appeared. It was nothing more than a dark spot against the shimmer of the sea. On a direct heading toward it, they began to pick up speed. A few minutes later, the boat began to weave back and forth.
That's our signal, Kurt said. Here goes nothing.
He reached forward and grabbed a red handle designed to release the cable in an emergency. One pull brought it back to a safety detent. A second pull finished the job. The cable snapped free with a metallic whine. The wingboard and the parasail rose unencumbered and began to slow. Leaning forward like snowboarders ready to move downhill, Kurt and Joe eased the craft into a mild descent. The wake of the powerboat vanished down below as Akiko turned away, and in a moment the only sound Kurt or Joe could hear was the wind blowing past them and the rush of blood in their ears.
Slight crosswind, Joe said. We're drifting to the south.
They leaned to the left and the board tilted beneath them. For an instant it felt as if it would slip away, but the brilliance of the twin wing system became evident as the parasail above corrected for any overzealous maneuvering done down below. Having adjusted for the wind drift, they overshot for 30 seconds and then turned back on course. The feeling was incredible. Kurt had made 100 jumps in various kinds of parachutes. He'd base-jumped in a wingsuit, and even flown an expendable glider nicknamed the Lunatic Express. But all those descents were either fast and furious, or slow and peaceful. The wingboard was somewhere in the middle, controllable with a simple body lean. It responded to the slightest weight shift, but there was a graceful sense to the pace. It moved at 40 miles an hour instead of traveling like a bullet the way you did in a wingsuit. This is like surfing the sky. Joe was grinning as broadly as Kurt. If we survive tonight, I'm going to make this my new hobby. Kurt glanced at the timer on his wrist and then at the altimeter. 800 feet, then just over a minute. We're more than halfway there. As they moved closer, the jagged black shape of the island grew larger and appeared to rise up in front of them. Even in the dark, there was something sinister about the place. Kurt could see waves breaking against it in splashes of angry white foam. The abandoned buildings looked like battlements in the low light. "Time to enhance our vision," Kurt said. Kurt reached up and pulled the infrared lenses over his eyes, while Joe pulled down the night vision goggles. Joe suddenly saw the island in green with gray tones. He could see the outlines of the buildings, the narrow, overgrown alleyways between them, and the rubble strewn in open spaces. The closer they got, the more dilapidated everything appeared. The island had been abandoned since 1974. Some of the buildings had fallen into disrepair before then. The place had survived several typhoons and hundreds of storms. The concrete shells of the buildings remained standing, but they were crumbling badly. The windows were all gone, and foliage growing in the gaps was doing its best to split the structures apart.
"We're right on target," Joe said, "but still drifting a little. We should have no problem clearing the first row of buildings and dropping on the second row closer to the center of the island."
"Can you tell the condition of the roofs yet?"
"Not really," Joe said, leaning to the left once again. "We're still too far away."
Kurt's view of the island was almost invisible. The cold concrete was actually cooler than the surrounding waters, making the island a dark void in a swath of gray. There were tiny dots of heat here and there, but based on their size, he knew they were probably rodents and birds that lived on the island.
"Any sign of the yellow brick road?" Joe asked.
"Not even a munchkin or a flying monkey," Kurt said. He scanned methodically, but the maze of buildings made it hard to see anything at ground level.
"Can we drift right a little and then come back against the wind? I need a better view of the alleys."
"We're getting closer," Joe said. "We'll have to make it quick." They shifted their weight to the right and the wingboard made a graceful turn. Kurt got a view between many of the buildings, spied a dimly glowing area, and made a mental note of where it was.
"Can we go a little more?"
10 more seconds, Joe said. "Then we turn back." Joe began a mental count as Kurt peered back and forth, looking for any sign of activity.
"That's it," Joe said. "Lean hard left."
Joe leaned into the turn and felt Kurt doing the same. As they threw their weight over and pulled on the control cables, the twin-winged glider pulled up and turned sharply.
"Level off!"
They were now dropping rapidly and picking up speed at the same time. The sea vanished, and the outer layer of man-made structures raced by, not far beneath the wing.
"We're going too fast!"
Pulling back on the chute stopped the descent momentarily. The glider ballooned upward as the speed dropped. By the time they leveled off and began descending again, Joe could see they were going to miss the landing zone.
"It's no good," Joe said. "We're going to overshoot and crash into the mountain. Divert to the left. We'll have to cross over and land in the open area at the front of the island."
Joe leaned into the turn. Kurt reacted instantly, and the wingboard curved toward a gap between the rock wall and the tallest building. To Joe's amazement, Kurt was still looking through the thermal imaging goggles, following Joe's instructions perfectly, while studying the island for heat sources.
"Straighten up," Joe said.
They were rushing toward the gap between the central peak and a building to its left. Joe calculated that they'd clear the gap with 20 feet to spare. Suddenly, Kurt pulled on the cables.
"Turn back," he shouted.
"What? Why?"
"Hard left," Kurt said, leaning over sharply.
Joe did as Kurt ordered, and they turned the wing board rapidly, whipping it around in a 180. This cost them a lot of speed and momentum, and they dropped fast on their new heading. Trees growing out from one of the buildings scraped the bottom of the wingboard, and Joe scanned ahead of them, searching for a landing zone. There was a wide roof 200 feet directly ahead of them, but he could see they'd never make it.
"Lean right," Joe said.
They curved back to the right, dropped farther, and thumped onto the roof of another building. The impact was hard enough that they bounced, skidded forward, and then spun when the right-hand tip of the wing clipped a vent. Joe was thrown from the bindings that locked his feet into position. He hit and rolled, tumbling several times and losing the night vision goggles in the process. He looked up to see the wing board sliding, stopping, and then moving again as the parasail caught the wind off the peak. Kurt was still locked into the bindings and was gathering in the sail as fast as he could. Joe rushed toward him, caught the other end of the parasail, and pulled hard. The parasail collapsed with his effort, and the wingboard stopped where it was. Before Joe could ask why Kurt had called for the dangerous last-minute turn, a helicopter rose up from the far side of the central hill and thundered overhead. It was heard more than seen, as all its lights were still out. "Sorry for messing up our nice approach and landing, but I caught sight of the heat plume from their engines before we crested the hill," Kurt said. "Another few seconds and we'd have fouled their rotors in a very painful way."
"I hope they didn't see us," Joe said.
He glanced into the distance. He could hear the helicopter traveling straight and low. It was still blacked out and moving away from the island. There was nothing to indicate anyone on board had spotted them.
"They must have been using our backup landing zone as a helipad. Awfully tight quarters to take off and land in. If I was the pilot, I'd be far more worried about the side clearance than keeping an eye out above me for anything that might be dropping in."
"They'd be coming back if they'd spotted us," Kurt said. "Let's get this chute tucked away." Kurt gathered the last of the parasail's material and wrapped it with the guide wires. Joe lifted the edge of the wingboard and helped Kurt shove the sail underneath. In the distance, the helicopter switched its lights on and banked toward the city.
"They don't seem to be coming back," Joe said. "But the real question is, did they take Nagano with them?"
Kurt shook his head. "It would make no sense to bring him here and then take him away. That was a shuttle run, a drop-off. He's here, all right. Probably with your old friend Ushione. They just can't keep the helicopter here for too long, on the chance someone would notice."
Chapter 43. Hashima Island.
Ushione stood by a dilapidated building watching the helicopter leave. He would have preferred to be on it, but Han had ordered him to stay behind and had promised to arrive shortly with his payment, assuming the swords were authentic. They'd better be authentic, Ushione thought to himself. He'd killed 3 policemen and 6 Shinto priests and monks to obtain them. He glanced at the sword in his hand. It was the famed Honjo Masamune, if the dying monks were to be believed. Ushione wasn't sure. He had to admit the weapon was light. In fact, it seemed to weigh almost nothing at all. And how it gleamed. All around him was rubble, crumbling concrete and tangled vines. The clouds were growing thicker and lower as the threatened storm closed in, but the sword caught what little light was reaching them and amplified it. Rumor had it that Masamune had worked crushed gemstones into his blades. Oni wasn't sure. He could see nothing of the sort, and such an act would make the weapons brittle and useless for fighting. But the weapon was almost luminescent in his hand. A rusted metal door opened behind him, and Han's lead scientist Gao poked his head out. Gao's face had a feral quality to it.
he reminded Ushioni of a rodent emerging from its den.
You need to come with me, Gao said. Han wants everyone inside.
Ushioni shook his head. He wasn't fond of closed-in spaces. Time in various prisons had seen to that. Besides, he was sweating. The fever was coming back. He needed more powerful antibiotics.
You go. I'm staying out here.
Suit yourself, Gao said, but I'll need the sword. We have to examine it in the lab. Instead of handing Gao the sword, Oni extended it toward the diminutive scientist, bringing the tip within an inch of Gao's chest.
After I've been paid.
Gao pulled back, putting some distance between himself and the blade. He took one more glance at Oni, and then retreated into the stairwell, shutting the decaying wooden door behind him. Oni turned to the surroundings. There was not much to see from his vantage point, only abandoned monoliths and a broken hill that had been hollowed out by the miners. Still, the ruined island begged to be explored. Oni could smell the rain coming, but he didn't care. It might even help quell his fever. Picking a direction at random, he crossed the open expanse where the helicopter had landed and walked out into the dark. Chapter 44 Roof of Building 37, Hashima Island. Kurt lay flat at the edge of the building. He studied the terrain through the infrared filter. The central mountain was on his right, while a 9-story building lay to the left. A concrete pedestrian bridge several floors below spanned the diagonal gap between the two. The hillside was dark and cold. Nothing resembling a heat source could be seen. The bridge was darker still, and the concrete shell of the building on the far side was like empty caves stacked one on top of the other. Joe crawled forward beside him. Kurt looked up.
Did you find the night vision goggles?
No,
Joe said. They must have gone over the edge.
Better them than us.
True, Joe said. See anything?
There's an oval swath down there in the clearing, Kurt said. Residual heat left behind where the helicopter sat for the last 2 hours.
Any sign of the passengers?
Not yet. No sign of a vent or doorway radiating heat. All these buildings are dark.
So much for the yellow brick road, Joe said.
As Kurt went back to scanning the buildings, the rain began to fall. It came lightly at first, tapping him on the shoulders with a soft patter, trickling through his hair. Soon it was falling steadily, not a tropical downpour, but cold, gray rain that would fall all night. Kurt ignored it for now, concentrating on the task before him. He studied the structures one by one, across and down, across and down. The tangled complex of buildings impressed him. Built over the decades, some were spaced so tightly there was barely an alleyway large enough for a bicycle to fit between them. Others had been built right into each other, with outer walls knocked down and hallways extended. Han's people could be hidden in any one of them. At least that was Kurt's initial impression. These buildings are more dilapidated than I thought, he said. A demolition crew would have a field day here.
Might not need them, Joe said. Some of these structures are partially collapsed already.
With Joe's words, it dawned on Kurt. I know where they are.
Did you spot something?
Not a thing, Kurt admitted. But if you were hiding on this island, would you set up shop in a building that could collapse at any moment? One that couldn't keep the rain out or the wind from howling through?
Joe grinned. Probably not. You think they've gone underground?
Kurt nodded. They dug coal out of this island for decades. The mine has several entrances and large open galleries where it's warm and dry.
Sounds inviting, Joe said. Let's go.
The first stairway they came to was a fire escape connected to the outside of a building. The rusted metal was flaking badly and had pulled away from the building in several places. Definitely unsafe. Kurt pushed on it with his boot and the entire thing swayed. That's not going to support either of us.
Let's find another way, Joe said.
He found a caved-in part of the roof where one side of a concrete slab had dropped. It angled down into the building like an off-ramp. The wet surface was slick, and they scaled it carefully, sliding the last few feet. The interior of the building was a dank, fetid world. Rainwater was dripping through 100 cracks in the ceiling. Plants and vines grew in many places. Several inches of muck covered the floor. Housekeeping must be on strike, Kurt mused. The infrared goggles were useless inside the dark concrete building, but they soon found an inner stairway, forced the door open, and began descending toward a bridge that led between two buildings. If we cross here, we can get down to the ground level without having to go outside, Kurt said. Staying inside won't keep us dry, Joe said, sidestepping some more runoff, but at least it'll keep us out of sight. They crossed the span with caution, avoiding the gaping holes and burgeoning cracks that suggested the bridge would not remain in place for much longer, and came out on the other side. Kurt dropped down to one knee and signaled for Joe to hold up.
I was wrong, Kurt whispered.
You?
No.
Kurt nodded.
Not everyone is out of sight. There's a patrol on the hillside. Two men. From up there, they will see us as soon as we hit open ground.
Patrolling in the rain was miserable duty. So thought every soldier who'd ever been forced to do it. Han's men were no different. They did as ordered, but they didn't have to like it. They started out hiking up the central hill that dominated the island. Climbing through the foliage was even more difficult than navigating the slick and well-worn stairs. They arrived at the top of the hill and took their positions.
You see anything?
The leader of the two asked. His partner shook his head.
Something's wrong with my equipment, he said, pulling off his night vision goggles. All I see are flares.
The leader pulled the hood back on his rain slicker and stepped over to his subordinate. Each of them had a pair of night vision goggles, but the scopes were less effective in the rain. Raindrops, like all water, bend and refract light. Studying the terrain through the falling drops was like looking through a kaleidoscope. The leader looked through the goggles and then handed them back.
Turn down the resolution.
He did the same with his own. The lightning in the distance was another problem. The goggles had a circuit that prevented it from blinding them, but it still caused flaring on the screen that lasted for several seconds each time it flashed.
Why are we even out here?
The subordinate said, putting his goggles back on and pulling the rain gear up over his head.
Because the boss wants you here, a voice said.
Han's men turned, but they were too late. One took a tree branch to the face, the other a gut punch and then a knockout blow to the back of the head when he doubled over. By the time they woke up, they were bound and gagged, tied to a tree, and had been relieved of their weapons, ponchos, and night vision gear. Dressed in the rain gear they'd taken from Han's men, Kurt and Joe looked more like they belonged. They crossed the hill, found another stairway, and made it down to ground level. Using the infrared goggles, Kurt spotted the residual heat from the helicopter once more. It was rapidly fading from the rain. He turned his attention to the walls beyond the landing area. Several openings had been cut in the mountain and were now barricaded. Through the human eye, they all looked the same, but through the heat-sensitive goggles, one of them shimmered a magenta color.
Across the field, Kurt said, the shaft on the far left. That's the one.
No sign of any guards, Joe said.
Let's not wait for any to show up.
Kurt flipped the goggles up once more and sprinted across the open ground. Arriving beside the tunnel, he pressed himself against the wall. Joe took a position right behind him. A quick look confirmed what Kurt needed to know.
Tunnel is empty, but venting heat.
Joe glanced up at the rain falling steadily from the heavens.
Warm and dry, he said. Looks good to me.
Kurt nodded. Without another word, both of them slipped quietly into the tunnel. The ground was turning to mud as Ushione continued his exploration of the island. He'd never been in such a haven of decay, and he found himself marveling at the beauty of it. The crumbling buildings, piles of rubble, and stark emptiness spoke to him.
"This is what the world would be like after men were gone," he mused. "It wouldn't take long for nature to erase the insignificant stain mankind had worked on the planet. Not long at all." The wind picked up as he neared the seawall, and he decided he'd had enough. He turned around, began the journey back toward the laboratory, and stopped. A faint glow was emanating from the debris ahead of him. He held still for a moment and then moved closer. The light vanished, and then reappeared. Using the samurai sword, Oni slashed at a bush that got in his way. The branches fell, cut clean through. The light was more visible now. Oni was looking at a tiny screen with a low-powered LED attached. He bent low and pulled it from the rubble. Recognition came instantly. He had in his hands a damaged pair of night vision goggles. The front plate was missing and the screen was cracked, but the goggles were still operating, and they were obviously the type military and police forces used to make assaults under cover of darkness. Oni looked around, expecting to be shot or attacked at any second, but nothing of the sort happened. Still, the high-tech device didn't just fall from the sky like a... The words died in his mind. He looked up at the vacant monolith beside him. The rain shrouded it in a jacket of mist and white noise. The damage to the goggles was consistent with a high-speed impact or a long drop. One side was dented and scraped, the other unblemished. Parts were broken off, and though he'd only made a cursory search, the missing parts were nowhere that Oni could see. Perhaps they did fall from the sky after all. He switched the damaged goggles off, clipped them to his belt, and went looking for a way into the building.
Chapter 45. Kurt and Joe moved quietly through the tunnel as it bent back and downward into the mountain. A small berm had been built toward the front to keep water out, but the rainwater pooled quickly and soon found its way around the rudimentary defense, traveling in a narrow channel at the center of the tunnel before vanishing over the edge of a vertical shaft that dropped into the depths. An elevator on the near side looked abandoned.
"This thing looks like it hasn't been used in years," Joe said.
Kurt took a brief look down the vertical shaft with the infrared scope. "No heat coming up the shaft, either. They're not down there. Must be farther back." They moved on, and soon found the first signs of recent occupation. The old electrical cables had been replaced, and the new wire along the wall was connected to a string of LEDs that glowed dimly. When they came to a split in the tunnel, Kurt studied the ground using the IR goggles. The residual heat of footprints could be seen. Most of them went left. Kurt followed. Joe put a hand on his arm.
"Are you sure?"
"Yellow brick road," he whispered. "We're in a high-traffic area." His faith was rewarded when they came to a pair of plastic-coated triple-sealed doors. The handle glowed from the heat of the last person to touch it. Kurt flipped up his goggles.
"Han has been doing some remodeling."
Joe nodded.
"Something tells me these aren't the hospitality suites."
Kurt tested the door handle.
"Unlocked," he whispered. "Let's make an entrance."
Switching off the safeties on the weapons they'd taken from Han's guards on the hill, they prepared to move into the room. With slow precision, Kurt pulled the handle down until it clicked and the latch disengaged. He eased the door open and felt a slight wave of air passing over him, as the room inside was kept at positive pressure. He pushed the door far enough for Joe to aim his weapon inside, but there was no one there to challenge them.
"Empty," Joe said. "Let's take a look."
Joe moved in first, and Kurt followed, shutting the door as carefully as he'd opened it. The room was unoccupied, but it was filled with equipment. Complex machinery had been bolted to the floor here and there. Shelves were stocked with prefabricated parts, gyros, servos, robotic arms and legs.
"Your friend Han should talk to someone about this robot obsession," Joe quipped.
About a lot of things, Kurt suggested. While Joe examined the parts on the shelf, Kurt moved deeper into the room, where he discovered a high-tech 3D printing machine. It had been left on, and was warm to the touch. He tapped the small screen on a control panel. A series of Chinese characters appeared along with a blank line for a password. He didn't waste his time trying to guess it, and moved on. Beside the 3D printer was a table, now tilted at a 45-degree angle. A sheet covered a figure beneath it. Kurt pulled the sheet back, expecting to find Nagano, tortured and deceased. Instead, he found the half-finished shell of another humanoid robot. No face, no body panels, just a frame with limbs and wires and a power cell. He noticed an air bladder covering the chest and a liquid reservoir. Joe arrived carrying two robotic arms. Can I give you a hand? Very funny. Dr. Frankenstein is nothing on this place. Kurt nodded, covered the unfinished creation with the sheet, and moved to the back of the room. He reached the far wall and realized it was made of smoked glass. He pulled the infrared scope down over his eyes once more, but saw only the reflection of his own heat. Pushing the goggles back up, he pressed his face up against the glass, shielding his eyes from any reflection and trying to discern what was on the other side. He couldn't see much, but he heard something. Or rather, he felt it. A vibration coming through the glass. A murmuring sound, as if several people were talking in low tones on the other side. He waved Joe over. Do you hear that? Joe put his ear up to the glass. Conversation? Too repetitive, Kurt said. It's the same words over and over again. More like chanting or praying. If I was Nagano, I'd be praying for help right about now, Joe said. They looked around for a door, discovered that one of the panels was held in place by a spring-loaded magnetic latch. Pressing it once released it, and Kurt pulled the door open. The droning sound grew in volume, but not clarity. Kurt stepped deeper into the chamber. There were more unfinished machines under sheets on medical tables around him, and down at the far end, a pair of figures standing in front of high-definition screens. They were watching, and then repeating what they saw and heard on the screen, both figures speaking the same phrases over and over. Kurt gripped his pistol and stepped closer. The figures ahead of him didn't react to him approaching at all. As if they were in a trance. He found a light switch on the wall, raised the pistol, and paused. Strangely, he recognized the phrase they were repeating. They were speaking English. And stranger still, he recognized the voice that was speaking that phrase. Japan will never be an ally of China, the image on the screen said. Japan will never be an ally of China. The standing figures repeated. Kurt flicked the switch. Neither of the figures reacted. They just kept speaking, starting and then stopping, and then starting over again in an endless loop. Kurt stepped around in front of them. The two figures were identical, complete with mussed silver hair, deep blue eyes, and 3 days of stubble. Kurt felt as if he was staring in a mirror. Two mirrors, actually. He was looking at robotic versions of himself. Ushione paused on the top floor of the dilapidated building. The stairwell to the roof was blocked by debris, but he could see the orange glow from the clouds coming through a gap in the ceiling. He marched toward it, scaled the ramp-like section of the caved-in roof panel, and paused at the top, scanning the entire roof before exposing himself. He saw it was empty. He climbed out into the rain once again and stood on the rooftop. He saw no soldiers or policemen or any parachutes or equipment, suggesting an assault on the island was beginning. But there was something out of place. A wide, flat object that gleamed in the low light, unlike every other dulled and corroded surface on the roof. The 12-foot wing looked like something that had fallen from a plane. But it was obviously in one piece. He found the parasail stuffed hastily beneath it. Austin, he said to himself. He turned with a start and charged back into the building, racing down the stairwell as the first echoes from Han's helicopter reached him. Han had to be warned, or Austin would destroy everything. Chapter 46 Hashima Island. Japan will never be an ally of China. Kurt listened to the words and could hardly believe how like his voice they sounded. Not in the odd way one's voice sounded on a recorded message, but as if the words were emanating from his own body. The screen flickered. A new video appeared. On it, the Prime Minister of Japan was mentioning the possibility of warmer relations with China. "We'll see about that," Kurt's robotic doppelganger said. The voices were off this time, especially the second robot's, which slurred the words just a bit. The scene repeated on the monitor. "We'll see about that," the robots replied, sounding now more like Kurt and more menacing at the same time. "They're learning," Kurt said, "practicing." "Wouldn't it be easier to program them with a recording and be done with it?" Joe suggested. "Like the robotic assistant in Nagano's police station." "That robot was instantly identifiable as a machine," Kurt said. "Its lips moved each time it spoke, but that was just a pretense. These robots are speaking, forming sounds with exhaled air and shaping that sound with their lips. They're breathing, blinking, even sweating. If I wasn't standing here, you might think one of them was me." "They're better looking than you," Joe said, then added, "Strange that there's no one here to monitor their progress." Kurt pointed to a bank of computer terminals and server units blinking in the dark. The displays on the screens were constantly evolving. "The computers are doing the monitoring. Machines, training machines. Something tells me this is a very repetitive and redundant process. Until the machines have learned how to act human enough, they probably do this over and over again." As Kurt spoke, the robots stepped forward and walked into a different room. Kurt followed. It was a simulator, similar to the one Han had in his factory, but smaller. To compensate for the limited space, there was a curved wall of screens, which lit up all around them. "That's the joint trade pavilion built with Han's money," Kurt said. "The Japanese Prime Minister is going to be there tomorrow to sign the new cooperation agreement with China. It's the deal everyone's been talking about. And the Japanese Parliament will vote on rescinding the joint defense treaty with America a few days from now," Joe said. "The symmetry is uncanny." "And not by accident," Kurt said. "But from what I read, the defense treaty isn't in any real danger. The Japanese want more business out of China, but they're not all that interested in going it alone militarily." The duplicates began moving forward, walking on treadmills. As they traveled, the scenery around them changed in a virtual sense. They entered through a back door and followed a route that led up to the main hall. Taking positions in the virtual crowd, they waited as images of the Japanese Prime Minister and the Chinese ambassador appeared on the stage. A digital representation of Walter Han was there as well, since he'd facilitated the agreement and the rapidly warming ties between the two countries. Handshakes first, and then the signing of a document. The ambassador signed on the right side before passing a pen to the Prime Minister. The pen was put to paper, and instantaneously both mechanical versions of Kurt reacted. They reached into their jackets, pulled out dummy pistols, and took dead aim. "Japan will never be an ally of China," they shouted, raising their weapons and pulling the triggers. There were no gunshots, of course. No blanks or even simulated noises, just clicking triggers and a pattern of red dots appearing on the screen as the system recorded multiple hits on the Prime Minister, the ambassador, and another politician. Their deadly task completed, both units took steps toward the right to begin their escape. The simulation ended there, and both machines went inactive and returned their pistols to their shoulder holsters. The video screens around them changed to a hotel lobby setting, and the duplicates walked to one side, where a pair of seats had been arranged. They sat down, crossed their legs quite naturally, and waited. There was nothing jerky and robotic about their movements. One of the robots even picked up a periodical from a table and licked its fingers before turning the pages.
"Surreal beyond words," Joe said. "If Han pulls this off, the whole world will think you killed the Japanese Prime Minister. It'll look like America is desperate to stop the Japanese from pulling out of the treaty, desperate to stop China and Japan from moving closer."
Kurt nodded. "He recorded me in his factory. Gave him enough to build this program."
"So much for the defense treaty not being in danger," Joe added. "If the world sees you shooting the Prime Minister, the vote to pull out of the treaty will be a landslide."
"Not if we destroy this lab and everything in it."
"I'm afraid that won't be allowed," a voice called out from the dark.
The words came from the far end of the room. The voice was Han's. Kurt turned, but there was no one there, only an intercom speaker attached to the wall. A door swung open behind Joe. Three men rushed in. Two more came in from the other end of the room, and Kurt took the only chance left to him, turning on his duplicates and opening fire. He drilled the first robot with several shots, but the machine responded with incredible speed. It leapt from its chair and charged at him, never wavering despite taking slugs to the chest, leg, and face. The robot tackled Kurt as cleanly as any professional wrestler, slamming him to the floor and knocking the gun from his hand. Forced into hand-to-hand combat with the mechanical version of himself, Kurt kneed the machine's solar plexus, but the blow had no effect. He worked one arm free and threw a right cross at the mechanical jaw. It split the artificial skin, but underneath lay only padding, titanium bones, and small hydraulic motors. In response, the robot put a hand around Kurt's neck and began to squeeze, cutting off the blood flow to Kurt's brain. Kurt reached up and dug his nails into the artificial flesh, pulling and ripping, desperately hoping to find wires he might yank out. It was not to be. There were no vulnerable organs, pressure points, or weak spots. No plugs to pull, or batteries he could remove. On the verge of blacking out, Kurt headbutted the machine and broke its prosthetic nose, but the machine only looked back at him with a blank stare and squeezed harder. As Kurt's world darkened, he heard Joe fighting with Han's human guards. He looked beyond the arms holding him down to see Joe on the ground, struggling with three men. One of them pistol-whipped him.
"Cease this foolish struggle, or you will both die painfully," Han called out.
The struggle was about to end, one way or another. Kurt chose to live and fight another day. He pulled his hands away from the robot and raised them in surrender. Thankfully, the robot stopped crushing his throat, though its mechanical hand remained in place. With the room now calm, Han strode in. The distinctive click of his shoes on the floor resounded with each step. He crouched beside Kurt and examined the bullet holes that had been drilled into the chest and face of the duplicate.
"Such foolishness," he began. "As I told you back at the track, a human is no match for a machine. My creation, my Kurt Austin, is superior to you in every way. Greater strength, greater speed, faster reactions. And, perhaps most importantly, an inability to feel pain or fear. Something you'll soon wish was a part of your limited human programming."
Chapter 47 Shanghai.
Gemma found she couldn't sleep. There was too much to worry about. Too much she couldn't control. Paul, on the other hand, was stretched out on the floor of the INN production van and slumbering as if he were in a king-sized bed at the Four Seasons. Gemma found she had an almost uncontrollable urge to wake him. She left him alone and took a seat at the editing station instead. It was 3 o'clock in the morning. The air had grown cold and damp in the van. It was still pitch dark outside, except for the security lights in the gated parking area. Unwilling to risk a hotel, as the van had been their accommodations for the evening.
But it wasn't a long-term solution. Even if the Chinese didn't figure out where they were, sooner or later someone from the network would attempt to use the van, or fuel it, or perform some maintenance on it. And even if none of those possibilities came to fruition, Gamay was certain that both of them would go stir-crazy before too long. Staring out into the darkness, she noticed movement. This time, she jabbed Paul in the ribs without hesitation.
"What's that for?" Paul said, awaking with a start.
"Someone's coming."
"Who?"
"I couldn't see."
"Was it a security guard?"
Gamay shot him a look.
"What part of 'I couldn't see' made you ask that second question?"
"Sorry," he replied, "half asleep." He rolled up the blanket and pushed it beneath an equipment locker and stood, banging his head against the low ceiling for the umpteenth time. "Now I'm awake," he said, stifling any expression of pain or anger. Peering out through the front window, they scanned the lot for any sign of someone moving around in the darkness. They saw nothing. A knock on the back door startled them both. Paul reached for the door.
"Paul!"
Gamay whispered in warning.
"What are we going to do?" he said, shrugging. "Besides, something tells me the secret police don't knock."
He flicked the lever to the unlocked position and the door swung wide. Instead of policemen or military personnel, the smiling, perfectly made-up face of Melanie Anderson appeared beyond. She climbed inside and shut the door.
"Why did you knock?"
"You know, Miss Manners and all that."
"Your mom would be proud," Paul replied with a smile. She placed an insulated cup down in front of them.
"I brought coffee. You'll have to share this.
But it would have looked odd if I'd brought three cups out to the van for myself."
"If you knew how much Paul has been dying for a cup, I'd think you were trying to steal him away from me,"
Gamay said.
Paul took the first sip and looked as if he'd just sampled waters from the Fountain of Youth.
"Oh, that's good," he said, handing the cup to Gamay. The aroma was enough for her at the moment. She turned back to Melanie.
"You said you were coming at first light.
Unless my eyes are going, it's not morning yet."
"Not my fault," Melanie said. "My bureau chief called and told me to come in early. He said we'd been hacked again and that it had something to do with my last report."
"But you weren't hacked," Gamay said. "We made all that up." "Which caused no small amount of worry on my part, let me tell you." She held up a zip drive. "When I got down here, the chief handed me this and walked away. Said he needed to make some hasty travel arrangements in case he had to leave China early. He suggested I seriously consider doing the same."
"What's on it?" Paul asked.
"Don't know," she told them. "It's encrypted. But the hack was done stateside. Our New York office was breached. Our satellite was compromised for 2 minutes, and then returned to our control after transmitting the information on here. It was the same satellite we used to get your signal out. So I'm guessing it's meant for the two of you. Care to take a look?"
Gamay took the zip drive from Melanie's hand, stuck it in the slot on the laptop, and powered up. A few moments later, she was looking at a login window. She used her Numa password and was rewarded with a list of files.
"It's from Rudy," she said, opening the first file. A presentation began on screen.
Paul was incredulous. "He sent a PowerPoint presentation? Instead of fake passports, disguises, and tickets for the Orient Express?"
Gamay laughed. "You know that train doesn't come this far east, right?"
"I was being facetious."
Gamay read through the first page of the file.
"Sounds like Priya has been working with the geology team in your absence. They've been studying what we sent them, and they believe they've figured out where the water is coming from. Han's mining operation created a deep earth fissure, releasing water from beneath the transition zone."
Paul leaned forward. "That's 200 miles down."
"Water under intense pressure," Gamay said, reading and summarizing. "Z-waves caused by the water being released from a mineral known as ringwoodite."
"Ringwoodite?" Paul said.
"Did I say that correctly?"
"Perfectly. It's just..." He hesitated. "Read on."
Gamay gave Paul a sideways look. He was holding back. But instead of prodding him to spill what he knew, she scanned the next few lines, again summarizing as she went.
Attached, you'll find our evidence and calculations, along with two separate presentations to use. One is highly technical. The other is done in generalities. Due to the vast amount of ringwoodite and the nature of the ongoing fractures, total hydraulic release cannot be calculated at this time. But if left unchecked, it would likely result in a seawater rise of 2,000 feet by end of decade. 2,000 feet? This from Melanie. Gemme double-checked to make sure she'd read it correctly. That's what it says. Read on, Paul said calmly.
Other calculations become speculative, she said, picking up where she'd left off, including a theoretical doomsday scenario, according to which the entire surface of the planet is covered in water within 50 years. Despite the extreme nature of this scenario, the possibility cannot be ruled out. For reasons that remain undetermined, the fractures of ringwoodite seem to be self-perpetuating and accelerating, branching in all directions and spreading. Each new fracture releases more water, which in turn causes additional fractures.
The three of them were crowded around the computer now.
And I thought I was the one who came up with crazy stuff, Mel said. Doomsday scenario? Entire world covered with water?
I know it sounds irrational, Paul said, but if the water is coming from that far down, it could be a real possibility. Believe it or not, there's more water trapped in the deep layers of rock than in all the oceans of the Earth. 3 or 4 times as much. It's trapped in the minerals and held under incredible pressure. But if that pressure was released and the water began forcing its way to the surface...
You know about this? Gemme said.
Of course, Paul said. It's deep Earth geology.
Why didn't you bring it up when we were first exploring the rise in sea level?
Paul shrugged. I considered it early on, but ruled it out as a possibility. The only process known to bring water up from that depth is a large magma plume, followed by volcanic eruptions, and volcanic activity was down for the past year. Gemme turned her attention back to the data put together by the science team. A graphic showed the fissures created by the Chinese mining operation. The crustal fractures extend downward beyond any existing measurement. They appear to be branching in all directions.
That's where that field of geysers came from, Paul said. We couldn't see to the end of the field. Who knows how many there are? Hundreds, maybe thousands, all pumping water up from the depths.
Gemme had overcome the shock of discovery and was quickly flipping through the other files.
What are you looking for? Paul asked.
Anything that mentions getting us out of here.
She came to a file labeled Instructions. Rudy has given us an address to proceed to.
Safe house? Paul asked, hopefully.
Gemme typed the location into the computer.
Not sure.
Melanie leaned over to look at the map. That's not a safe house, she said. That's the Shanghai Bureau of the Ministry for State Security, local headquarters of the secret police.
Paul leaned back. And I thought Rudy was on our side.
Maybe he thinks it's the last place anyone would look for you.
He's not asking us to hide there, Gemme told them, reading on. He wants us to turn ourselves in, but only to a man named Zhang.
Make that a general named Zhang.
Paul sighed. Well, that ought to speed up our trial and make it easy to get a firing squad together.
We have to trust Rudy on this, Gemme said. He's obviously got something in mind.
Paul nodded. Can we borrow the van?
Mel shook her head. And lose my exclusive on the biggest story ever? Not on your life. You two share the coffee. I'll drive.
Chapter 48 Hashima Island. Walter Hahn watched as the robotic facsimiles of Kurt Austin returned to the workbenches and lay down. The movements were both as smooth and as awkward as any human's. One machine limped where a shot from Austin's gun had damaged its leg. It hopped up on the bench, favoring the injured leg and grasping for balance as it reclined. Reddish liquid oozed from the bullet wounds and soaked the right leg and torso. The second robot was undamaged.
Hydraulic fluid? Hahn asked.
No, Gao said.
We used a layer of gel between the artificial skin and the